prospective medical record access is a key thing that's going to start in a few weeks, effectively, for every practice across the entire country. And there are definitely pros and there are absolutely some cons as to how this is going to work. And in this session, we're joined by the team from TPP telling us about how this is going to work for you, for your practice, for your teams, and especially for your patients. So let's get cracking as we take in hands your primary care. Hello, EGP learners, and welcome to this session where I'm joined by Matt Curtis from TPP, who's going to be talking to us about prospective medical record access. Now, I know this has got a variety of names. At one point, it's called advanced access, which is weird why they called it that. But hey, there was a reason. But effectively, we're going to be talking about how this is going to work for your practice, particularly obviously using TPP System 1, some of the stuff that's been developed to try and help this process for practices, and also trying to answer as many of your questions as possible as we can in the time that we've got. But just before we get started, Matt, do you want to introduce yourselves to those who may not know who you are?
Hello, everybody. Thanks for inviting me. My name is Dr. Matt Curtis. I'm a clinical advisor with TPP, and the majority of my week is spent being a GP in West Yorkshire. So this is a subject that is not only close to my TPP heart, but it's becoming an increasingly hot topic in our practice, as I'm sure it is in other practices around the country. So hopefully the conversation we have today will obviously present the TPP functionality that will enable people to switch this on, but also I'm hoping that we can have a conversation about some of the issues that practices will have raised or will have raised to them in the near future.
Absolutely. And I know we've had a variety of questions come through on some of the social media channels, like the S1FBUG Facebook group in particular. We've had a few questions come through for that, which we'll get to once we've covered the functionality. There's lots of questions about the appropriateness of how this is working and should we be doing and all that kind of stuff. I think important to recognize for this session, we're focusing absolutely on the TPP side of things, because that's what Matt's here to talk about. We'll try our best to cover some of the other stuff, but important to recognize this is likely to happen, and it's been delayed a few times, but from the 1st of November, it's going to be switched on. It is a contractual requirement for practices to do so. We're going to signpost you some other resources towards the end that may help with some of the whole logistics and that kind of stuff within the practice, but like I said, we'll see what we can cover at this point. Where did you want us to start, Matt?
So I think you're right. We can, I'm sure everybody, not just clinicians, but everybody in the country will have a view about this. There'll be some people who are enthusiastic, some people who are less enthusiastic. And we could happily spend an hour and beyond talking about it. But what we want to do today is focus on the facts. So we'll focus on the functionality. In November, when this switches on, as we are expecting it to, this is actually going to be quite a small change, but it's a change that will affect a lot of people. So the issues of access to records and the issues of whether the information in that record could potentially be harmful to the patient, whether it's incorrect because it's about the wrong person, whether it contains information given by a third party, or if it contains information about a third party, are issues that predate the use of computers. Now, from 2015, I think, if my memory serves me correct, we've had a contractual responsibility to provide online access. And from 2019, we've had a contractual responsibility to offer full record access. And what happens in November is just the next step along the pathway of citizen involvement in their medical records. So many of the things that we're going to be discussing, or many of the things that we won't be discussing, are not specific to the November switch on. They are about access to medical records.
Okay. Now, I know that we've got a video to play that goes through some of the functionality. Shall we do that now? Do you think that'll be useful?
It's a wonderfully short video focused on the fact that there's not a big change happening. There are important changes, but they're not big changes. So pay attention, blink and you'll miss it. But everything that you need to know, we hope will be on the screen for the next 2 or 3 minutes.
No problems. And if you do miss it, don't worry. After the event, I'll stick all the timestamps and stuff so you can go back and watch this. And more importantly, share this with your teams, because this does cover the variety of ways that you can basically do the access stuff. I know I've got some videos to help people, but this has got some new functionality that's not in my content, so definitely have a look at this. So we're just going to put that on for you right now.
The changes on system one following the prospective access rollout. So here we just have our organisation preferences, and what you have set in the full clinical records section here is what will end up applying to any patients converted by the prospective access change. All of this information can also be found in our prospective access guidance, which can be found on system one. The only setting that will change here following the conversion is if you have consultations from the date of consent onwards set, it will change to consultations from the later of their registration date or the date of conversion. When you register a patient, these settings will match the ones selected in your organisation preferences. There are multiple ways you can hide consultations from the online record in System 1. Right-clicking on an individual consultation, you can choose for it not to show in the online record. You can select multiple consultations and use the toolbar to hide them all in the online record. You can also use event details to hide visibility of the current consultation. So when you're processing documents, we've added a new setting where you can set whether or not this document is visible in the online record. This will default to ticks unless you've already hidden this. If you have auto-filing turned on for your path and radiology results, we've added a new setting where you can select when reviewing them whether they're visible in the online record. And before reviewing, this will be automatically not visible in the online record. If your organisation's using client APIs, then third-party software may be adding data to the patient record without the user being in it. This means you won't be able to hide the visibility before the record's saved. So TPP have done a new preference which allows users to auto-hide visibility of information coming in through client APIs. For any patients, an organisation field should not be included in this bulk conversion to prospective access. An exclusion code can be added to the record using a bulk action. This bulk action can be done on any list of patients, for example, those included in a clinical report. Further information can be found in our System 1 prospective access guidance along with FAQs. Thanks for listening.
So as Matt mentioned, if you blink, you might miss it. But don't worry, you can go back and watch that video in particular. There is some new functionality that I know has been added in the past month, so particularly that functionality about redacting information from letters in particular is a new thing, so I've not seen that one in particular. But obviously that covers the various different ways that you can adjust the visibility of the information itself. Anything you wanted to add at this point, Matt?
Plenty. There's lots to unpack actually in that short video, particularly for our colleagues who are maybe not as familiar with enabling online access or adjusting the organisation preferences. So where shall we start? I think the key thing is making sure that your organisation preferences are currently set up to enable record access, because if they're not, then regardless of what the patient's individual settings are, if the organisation isn't enabling it, then nothing's going to work and you're going to have potentially quite a few perplexed patients on whatever day in November it is. I'm going to hold this up. One of the problems is that, it works. The mirroring sometimes plays tricks on me. So this is our user guide for accelerating citizen access to GP data. Full instructions are there. And of course, the video is there to refer back to. But make sure that your organization preferences are correctly set prior to the November switch on date. So that's tip number one. Reminder number two is that patients who already have online access, and there's lots of them, their experience won't be changed, shouldn't be changed by this. So if you already have full access to the record, then that will persist. If you already have access to the detailed coded record, that will persist, but then from November you'll get prospective access to the full record. And I'll stop talking now, because when I start to explain this any more detail, I end up confusing myself, let alone the audience. I'll hand back to you, Gandhi.
So I know one of the key things that keeps coming up with this record access in particular is this difference in the levels of kind of people have. So some will have, obviously, some organizations have summary care records. You just mentioned some people have detailed care access, and some people have full access. And obviously from the 1st of November, all patients theoretically should have full record access moving forward. Mm-hmm. What does that mean in terms of the stuff that I guess we do? So obviously there's various parts that the system on that some people think is visible, is not visible. Can you give us a rundown effectively of what the patients will be able to see?
Yeah, so it will include the diagnostic codes that are entered. It will include the notes from the consultations. It will include the documents and the pathology results. It won't include things like reminders and tasks and this or that more administrative appointment data. And this is for online viewing. It's important, I think, always to remember the visibility online is similar but subtly different to what somebody might get from a subject access request, where a greater quantity of the medical record is released via that. So it's the to keep it simple, it's the consultations, the results, the communications, and the diagnostic codes. And it's only for the organisation that you are controlling. So, you know, the great strength of System One has always been the visibility of the contributions made by other organisations. Those contributions won't be visible to the patient via online services. It's up to those other organisations to enable online viewing. So, you know, community nursing services, child health, and so forth.
So that's a big one, which I know is often comes up. So as you mentioned, if my patient, for example, has seen the health visitor, you know, parents have taken the child to the health visitor, the parents won't have access to the health visitor records unless they've applied separately to that organisation for access, which probably wouldn't work through the same portal, I would imagine, unless you've got some different portal available.
No, I mean, theoretically, and it may well, it's probably in use somewhere in the country. Patients who have a care record on System One in a community organisation, such as health visitors, will be able to view that through AIRMID if that organisation has enabled it. So it's probably happening somewhere. I don't have a list of who's using it at the moment. So if patients want it, they can have it, but it's probably best if they talk to that organisation about it rather than the GP as the intermediary.
And I guess the other one I wanted to pick up on, so you mentioned, so tasks would not be visible to the patients, because I know that's one that comes up quite often, because obviously we use tasks as an administrative tool for many practices. You know, so just for clarity, tasks that are sent won't be visible to the patient unless obviously that task is copied into the bulk of the record itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, remembering that a task can at times leave the organisation. So I can send a task to my colleagues in the at the local hospice, and that task sort of sits outside of the record that I control at my organisation in that respect. So that's one of the reasons why tasks won't be visible.
Okay. I know we're going to, I'm keen to get questions from the audience. So if you do have any questions, please feel free to stick that in the chat, whichever platform you're watching us on. I know we've got a couple of comments coming through. Just before we get to those, I'm going to go to the really common questions I've been having. And it's about a couple of things that you've mentioned already, but probably going into a bit more detail. So first one is, as you mentioned, diagnostics and results. At what point are they visible to the patient?
So there are two ways that the result is filed in System One. There are some organisations that have got auto-filing, and there are some organisations that don't. And without going too deeply into the differences between those two, a result will not be visible to a patient via patient-facing services until it has been reviewed by the clinician. And if you're using the old style, then that is called filing. And if you're using the new style where it's auto-filed, it's called reviewing. And The okay. terms review and filing are often used interchangeably. But the key thing is that at the point when the clinician looks at the results, whether that's a blood result or a microbiology result or a radiology result, many of you have already noticed that there's a new button, a new box near the bottom of the filing window, which enables the result to be visible to the patient via online services. And I think the usual setting would be for it to be automatically visible, and then the user can choose to untick that. And you can dream up all sorts of scenarios where that would be a really good idea. You know, for instance, the result of an X-ray that has got a diagnosis, a life-changing diagnosis of lung cancer, it would be less than ideal if the patient's first knowledge of that is when they look on their computer that evening. Mm-hmm. Most of us would prefer to give that information in a more supportive and structured way. The difficulty, and that's a very clear example. There are other blood test results like diabetes or the possibility of prostate cancer, which again fall into that category. There are softer ones where one clinician may choose to tick the box and another clinician may choose not to. But that's medicine.
Mm-hmm. So with the filing then, those results are visible at the point they've been filed, and based on what your current system settings are, may predicate what that is, but there is the option of selecting to not have that visible within the patient record at the point of filing as well. Is that a good summary?
Yes.
Awesome.
Be aware that there are some results that just appear in the record automatically. So one of the great successes of System 1 during the pandemic was that the results of COVID swab results would be automatically put into the record, and clinician wouldn't have to file them. And those automatically filed ones, we're now enabling people to choose whether those automatically filed things are going to be viewable online before or after a clinician's reviewed.
Okay. Any other examples you can think of that would be, I guess, worth practices being aware of? I mean, the COVID one is definitely a mass practice one. I must admit, I was struggling to think of other examples that would make me concerned automatically, because I guess we don't have that many auto filing ones.
And I think that this is where it's going to be difficult for System 1 to give clear guidance, because there are so many integrations out there with different products. There are some which are, you know, for instance, the ingestion of a vaccine given by another provider, like a community pharmacist. Most of us would be happy for that to automatically appear in the medical record, because the patient was there when it happened. They know they've been vaccinated. I don't need to screen it beforehand. But there may be some automatic ingestions of information where it could be a PDF document, and I don't know what the content of that PDF document is. And so my default for that would be to not file it until somebody's had a chance to review it. I think that NHS 111 message is an example of that.
Okay. So moving on to documents, probably a good segue here. Mm-hmm. Documents obviously come into the system through a different route that pathology results generally do. Mm-hmm. At what point are those documents visible?
Again, once the document has been processed, the observant people may have already noticed that there's a new box that enables people to tick at the point of document processing whether it's going to be visible or not. It's worth reminding people that both blood tests and documents have always been possible to make online visible or not. I must confess, in the past, it's been quite a clicky process. So the things that have been introduced recently don't add any extra functionality, but they make it a lot easier for users to do it. And they do it and they introduce that option at a more logical stage in the process.
Okay. So again, just for clarity, once in a typical workflow for a clinician, you've got some letters in your bottom toolbar to file these allocated to you specifically. They're not visible to the patient through online access until you've actually filed them into the record and decided whether or not they are visible to the patient through online access using the new functionality that you've just shown earlier. Is that correct?
Exactly. You explain it much better than I did.
I have to explain it this way just so I remember more than anything else, which is really important because I think the key thing about this change is going to change processes within practices, and it's just being aware that there is a subtle change for a lot of this in terms of those process changes.
Yes.
I know one that keeps coming up is this whole concept of redaction through the record. And the terminology in particular being used now is one that's causing some people for not concern as such, but confusion is probably the best way of describing it. Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, because you're the expert on this, you can't redact individual parts of a document. You can only redact the whole document or none of it. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And likewise, in a consultation, you can't blank out words in a consultation. One makes the consultation not visible online. And so in that situation where a clinician wants to have some of the information visible online, but some of it not visible online, it's important to break that up into separate consultations, separate events.
Do you want to know how to use System One more effectively as a clinician? There are various different things you can look at, but there is only one course that can help you understand this and have all my hints and tips on how to use System One so much more effectively. And that's the System One course for clinicians. If you want to have a look at it, have a look bit.ly/TPPS1course, TPP and S1 in capitals. But if you do have a look at it, what will you get? Well, you'll get content and information and guides on how to use System One more effectively, from getting started with System One, to navigating the patient record, to understanding the key parts like doing a consultation, as well as prescribing, clinical admin, communication, and various other information. And this includes my hints and tips on how to use System One so much more effectively, so it saves you time and your patients stress in terms of their navigation with their patient journey. If you want to have a look at it, check out the link. As I said, it's bit.ly/TPPS1course, and the TPP and S1 are all in capitals, and you will get access to all this content perfectly. Even better yet, there's a money back guarantee. So if you don't actually find this course has helped save you some time, just let me know. I'll refund you the course once you've completed it and stuff. Catch you then. Okay. So again, possibly a process change. If you're dealing with multiple issues within one consultation and one part of that potentially is quite sensitive, possibly, for example, a safeguarding issue or third-party information you've been given, it may require that different process of the way that you actually input that information to the records rather than one big consultation and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And I guess another question when it comes to document management, some places may use third-party tools. I guess DocMan's a commonly used tool for document management and stuff. Is there any differences for people who use DocMan as their interface for the documents versus System One? I don't know if there is anywhere, but you may know better.
I'm not a DocMan user, so and I'm not aware of any differences. But I wouldn't profess to be the last word of truth on that subject.
Okay. And you mentioned third-party provider information was covered in the video. So I guess we're looking at and considering things, particularly like the online consultation providers that input information and that's copied over into the records through different routes and APIs and that kind of stuff. Is there anything people need to be aware of from that point of view? Is there any other processes they need to think about and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So just to recap, the visibility of the record through online services will be obviously through things like AIRMED, the NHS app and System Online, but there's all sorts of other patient-facing services. And the settings for us as a practice are the same for all of those. So you don't have to configure it differently for the NHS app than you do for AIRMED. So that side of things, even though there's a variety of providers where patients can look at their record for the practice, you only make one change and that applies to everything. The other way, incoming information, it's very much dependent on each integration, each API that a practice has. And what we are setting out is a toggle switch for each API, whereby the practice chooses whether the default setting is for that information to be visible or not visible. And the practice will need to make a judgment. Firstly, you know, they'll know which APIs they have integrations with, and they'll know the type of content that they receive via that API. And if it's the kind of API where it's something that the patient clearly knows already, like a vaccination, for instance, that's a relatively straightforward one. If it's the kind of one where, say, an online consultation is made with a third-party provider, and the third-party provider then replies and that goes straight into the medical record, most of us would choose to accept that from being online visible straight away until it's been reviewed by the clinician. That is in the category of what people refer to as asynchronous. The message arrives and sometime later I might look at it. In situations where the message is arriving in real time and I can see it, then I can make a judgment there as to whether it should be visible or not. So it's a bit like a normal consultation.
Okay. So I've had a couple of extra questions come through on the chat, so I'll bring those on if that's all right. So first question or comment more than anything else was from Susie. So she was saying, can we watch this again and can we share it with us in the future? Absolutely.
Yes,
you can
yes.
Watch it. Yeah, so best place to find it's going to be on the EGP Learning YouTube channel. Search for it. It's under prospective record access and it's definitely shareable through that route. And feel free to share it far and wide if you want to.
And I'd encourage to read it in conjunction with the online user guide as well, which is a bit more detailed. But what we wanted was a short, snappy video image so people can see the screens that are relevant.
Absolutely. And the links to those guides will be put up shortly afterwards, along with some other links that we're going to have in a short while for everyone as well. Next, we've got from Lifebonk Quay Medical Centre. Great name there. Are admin notes visible? Some of the admin and reception teams are concerned about their whole name being visible to the patients. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah. Admin notes shouldn't be. Yeah, I'll need to check on that. I'm fairly sure they won't be, but I'll come back to you with a proper answer soon after this.
Sure. I guess because obviously there are different ways that people document information. You've obviously got consultations, you've got admin notes, you've got quick notes as well. Because obviously when you input it, it can be considered a different route and stuff. So how that's captured and that kind of information. Yeah, they are different kind of things. So I know sometimes I find it weird that I put the searches on for my own documentations and the quick notes don't always come up. It depends on whether you've documented an administrative quick note or a clinical quick note, I believe. It seems to be a differentiating factor.
And it's the whether you have, whether it's clinically relevant or not clinically relevant, other things,
yes.
Which are the things that most people determine. On that sort of what can be seen, what can't be seen, I forgot to say at the beginning that this only applies to people who've got full GMS registration for the practice. So other registrations and the contents of other registrations won't be visible. It only applies to people over the age of 16. And it also the big switch on when it happens in November, it won't apply to people who have the exception code. And forgive me if I get my lines wrong, but the wording of the code is enhanced review of medical record required before something. It's got a very long SNOMED number, which I definitely won't remember. But I have written down the CTV code, the system on code, which is capital Y 2 little f little f little e. So people who have a requirement to have their record checked before the big switch on won't be automatically included until the latter code of enhanced review not required is then added.
Okay, so that code again was capital Y.
Capital Y to little f, little f, little e.
Okay, so I hope I've got this right, and Matt's going to tell me if I've got it right. I'm just going to stick it on screen for everybody. So hopefully the exception code is capital Y 2 little f little f little e.
And it may be worth talking about that. I'm going to check this as we speak, because sometimes I can't read my own handwriting. There we go. Yes, enhanced review indicated before granting access. There we go.
So if there was a reason you didn't want to give full record access, that would be the code that needs to be put into the patient's record. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe worth talking about that briefly. So are there any situations you would envisage where that would be appropriate? I know in my head I've got a couple, but feel free to go.
Yeah, and I think this is where there's going to be a lot of worry from the profession about, you know, getting it right, being too zealous or being not zealous enough in how one approaches this. Whilst I have a view as a GP, it's not necessarily a view of TPP and Sister One, so I'm just talking as a normal GP. But the prospect of securely identifying the right patients for that code to be applied to in an 8-week period is a challenge. And the ways in which those patients can be correctly identified, I don't think there's a consensus. Everybody's got an opinion. The gist of it, the simple thing, is anybody for whom sight of information in their medical record could be damaging. So it could be information that they hitherto didn't know, and it comes as a nasty shock. Or I suppose the hottest topic that's happening at the moment would be the one whereby if that information was viewed by another person, not the patient, and that person had a position of power or coercion over the patient, and the patient then came to harm because of the information that the other person had seen.
I guess that brings in the concept, like you said, of proxy access, which is that process whereby, there's two parts, isn't it? So there's one person where someone, like you said, have a position of power, for example, in a relationship or a caregiver for an individual, takes over the actual direct access that the index patient has, versus proxy access. So a carer who would normally support the patient, who has been supportive in their care, but then has direct access through proxy. Through the NHS app, I think, is the main route, if I remember rightly.
Yeah,
those are, I guess, two issues.
As well. Yeah. And the prospective access switch on will bring that information to be visible as well to the proxy as well.
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's that question and that process that practices have to go through as to what types of patients or what situations for patients they would feel would be appropriate to use the exception coding. So I guess I know in my practice, when we're talking about safeguarding patients, patients on our safeguarding register, should they as an automatic be having the code, and then that can be reviewed and taken off if felt appropriate, just as a matter of safety. Proxy access, I guess, is another one, because it probably needs that discussion first about the access rights, whether the patients are still happy for, their proxies to have full access to their records, which may not be the initial discussion prior. There's a difference between, I guess, contacting and arranging appointments and discussing care versus being able to see absolutely everything from day dot and stuff.
That's right.
So I guess those are possibly discussions people need to be having within their practice to how they're going to approach those situations.
And it depends on your practice. NHS Digital, I think, and apologies if I've misquoted them, but they came up with an estimate of about 2% of the practice population who they would anticipate this exclusion code being applied to. When we ran the numbers in our practice, which is in quite an urban part of West Yorkshire, we were closer to 10%, we felt. So there'd be a huge variety in the number of patients for whom this code could be used. The great thing about general practice is that it's full of fantastically ingenious and inventive problem solvers. So there's all sorts of ways that one can mitigate this. Remembering, because it's prospective access, it's actually not something that's going to be a problem until the record is used. and you can mm-hmm. construct protocols based on reports to say, should this patient be considered for full online prospective access from mm-hmm. going forward. So rather than having to go through the entire practice list, you can do it as and when the person's record is accessed. Mm-hmm. And you can construct reports, like say, from the safeguarding register, but you could also consider other structured coded entries which your practice might wish to include in a possible list of people who should be more carefully considered before prospective access starts.
Mm-hmm. And I guess to help with those kind of things, so we mentioned there was a couple of resources that we can direct people to have some extra support in terms of understanding that. So I'm just going to put a couple of those on the channel. So the first one, I did a live stream with Dr. Amir Hannan, who, if you've come across, has been very pro in terms of patients having access to their records and has been doing record access for his subset of patients for many years. He's got his own views on the current change in terms of prospective medical access, and I would highly recommend having a watch of that particular session, because we talk about the logistical challenges and processes. What I find really effective from him is that he's got this form that he sends out to all patients to effectively pre-screen his patients as to whether or not it's safe for them to have record access. And then based on that, that then leads to a different discussion whether it's appropriate or not for those patients. So definitely have a look at that. There's some really good links in there. Additionally, there's a group called Redmore Health who I've done some work with in the past. They've created something called the Digital Journey Planner, which we covered on the channel a few months back, and lots of practices are now starting to roll out and use. In those resources as well, they've created some of those searches, those protocol-based searches that Matt has mentioned, to try and help practices. For that part, you do need to be part of their membership scheme to access that specific thing, but the initial stuff is definitely available for free in the digitaljourneyplanner.co.uk. So if you are concerned about this stuff, do check out those two resources. I think they will provide some additional benefit in terms of information and stuff for practices that are concerned about how this will work in the 6 weeks time frame I think we've got left before it all kicks off and stuff.
The clock is ticking, that's right. Have you got other resources that you're going to mention as well?
Yes, so I will put down the online access guide that you've shown, and the links that I'll put down below. I don't have it at hand here, the web link, but so those that are watching on YouTube, or if you're watching on Facebook, if you go to the YouTube channel, it will be coded under there. And if you're listening to this on the podcast afterwards, which I upload shortly afterwards, again, it'll be in the show notes from there. And so that hopefully answers Howard's question as well in terms of how, where can we get the TPP access guide. I can't remember the exact web link at this point, so I will find out for you and put that underneath the links and stuff for you. Additionally, we will be replaying this at the System One Facebook User Group Conference, which is on the 11th of October, which you're all more than welcome to join. If you want to do so, there's the link, bit.ly/S1FBUG22, where Matt's going to be giving a plenary talk, talking about what's coming from System One in the near future as well.
Could I just interrupt you as well? A few other things, the NHS Digital website has got some information about this. The RCGP online toolkit is a really good resource, not just for this, but for the whole issue of enabling online access. 6 weeks, it's not much time, as you say, and we've got quite a lot of other things going on in general practice at the moment as well. So we want to try and make this as light touch as possible. This is a great opportunity to ensure that all of our colleagues, all of our clinical colleagues, all of our admin colleagues understand how to make records, make an entry visible online or not. So this is a good nudge to remind people about the things that they sort of should know already, but what they can be forgiven for it being forgotten. So this is a good opportunity to do a refresher. So make sure that all of your users are familiar with how to hide data or make data visible on the online record.
Yep. So if you did want to check that out as well, so there is a video on the EGP Learning channel, which is a how to redact information on System One. And that covers all the ones that we've seen, apart from the document one, because that's a new process that's coming into place. Had a couple more questions for you, if that's all right, Matt. Yeah. So from Neil, he's raised a question of, I've heard that patients can change Word documents if saved in a non-finalized state. Is that correct? And I know this possibly speaks to the next stage of prospective access, which is patients being able to write to their records as well.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Anything is possible in the world of computers. I'd love to see when that happened and how it happened. So if you do have a specific example of that, please let us know. It sounds curious.
Absolutely. So, Neil, if you are still watching this, let me know. I know you've got my contact details and stuff. I can pass that on to Matt and we can just clarify that. In addition, we'll clarify that admin note, quick note thing, which was a question from a random Facebook user. I'm confused now. Is the admin note different to the quick note? No, it's effectively the same thing, but you can choose whether it's clinically relevant or not clinically relevant and therefore making it administrative. So apologies, it may just be the terminology we're using there. Important.
I mean, that's, I think I know the answer, but rather than I'll wait until I'm 100% certain and give the correct answer rather than going with my gut instinct.
And we mentioned earlier that this is potentially going to be changing the processes and stuff. Again, random Facebook user, GPs tend to file results and send a task themselves /admin to contact the patient. Do we need to rethink if this, if the patient can see the results at the point of filing? I think it comes down to the process and practice, isn't it?
It's a really good question. Remember that making the result not visible online is not set in stone forever. So one could always revisit that result in a few days or a few weeks' time to make it visible online once the conversation's been had. But all of us, the great thing about primary care is that we are full of problem solvers and everybody has their own method of doing this process. So I'd hate to dictate my way to the entire System 1 population.
Fair enough. And Matt, we may need to change your name to Mystic, Matt, because you've kind of answered one of the other questions we had already. So if you withhold the online viewing of a test result, can you then enable it to be viewed at a later date? Yes, is the clear answer to that. Yeah. And also you can change it the other way around if you need to as well. Obviously, it's something that is just a flick of a click more than anything else. Interesting, we've had Dr. Amir Hannan join us as well on the chat. He's mentioned it about, I think, EMIS in particular allowed people to change the documents, but that's not possible now, so hopefully that shouldn't be available. Neil did come back saying that no specific example, but one of the London CCGs apparently raised this and stuff. However, there have been apparently comments of, I'm aware people have downloaded FitNotes and then tried to change it themselves and send it to the employer. Of course, this is illegal, so it does sound like we're going to have new problems to solve as things change, which is an interesting one. Obviously, as we moved away from physical signatures for FitNotes, the digital signing of them is an interesting thing that may require changes. I know we've occasionally had some companies contact us asking if this note is genuine or not, and we've had a couple that weren't. So it is, as you said, anything theoretically is possible with computers if you've got the will and the way. Yeah, I can see Matt nodding across to that one and stuff.
I'm not that way inclined, but if I was criminally minded, the document that a fit note is not the most difficult thing in the world to create a plausible forgery of. People have been forging banknotes for centuries, so fit notes are a relatively low challenge in comparison to that, although probably less valuable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So Ed's come up with an interesting comment. So can TPP change the NHS 111 filing process so that the copy messages can be automatically filed and automatically hidden from online access? Otherwise, we'll have to revert to processing them manually.
That's a fantastic suggestion from Ed. We love Ed's suggestions. If you could send that to me in a written form, I'll look into that one because it sounds sensible.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, Ed. And hopefully Ed will be joining us, like I mentioned, at our upcoming System 1 Facebook User Group Conference. So just for those that missed it, it's on the 11th of October. We've got some amazing presentations planned, including how to hopefully solve some of the challenges you've got in practice. And Matt doesn't know this, but me and Andy are unveiling something new at the conference that hopefully will be of use to anybody who uses System 1, particularly new users. So we've got something big hopefully planned if we can get around to doing it. It's one reason why I've had to take today off to try and get cracking on it. But we've got some new stuff planned for you that hopefully will be of use to all of our System 1 users out there. Matt, thank you very much for your time. I know it's very valuable, and
it's been great
on this topic as well. I know it's been one that's caused a lot of anxiety for many practices, and just wanted to make sure that they're doing things correctly, but also more importantly safely and stuff. And I think hopefully the content of this stream, as I said, if you do want to go back and watch it, for anybody, feel free to do so. There's lots of content there for you that will hopefully help manage the processes, including switching on at record access, which, as we mentioned, is a GMS contractual requirement, but also the processes you need to think about within your practice to make this flow as safely as possible, both for your practice teams as well as for your patients. All those resources I mentioned will be down in the links below and probably coming up right now about here, some other videos and stuff that you can check out, or links to them so you can have a listen at the other content we talked about in terms of the other sessions as well. Thank you, Matt. I'll next be seeing you at the conference where everyone's welcome to join us. And as always, we're here to help tech enhance your primary care and learning. And we'll catch you in the next episode. Later.
Thanks, everybody.
Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question, because let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, to tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.